Welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with Greg Prado about his book, Too High to Die, Meet the Meat Puppets, self-published in 2012 at Lulu.com. An oral history, Too High to Die, traces Meat Puppets' history through stories told by Kurt Kirkwood, Chris Kirkwood, and Derek Bostrom, the band's three original members, as well as Ted Marcus and Shandon Salm, members of the band's most recent incarnations. There are also interviews with other musicians significant in the lives of Meat Puppets: Paul Leary, Chuck Dukowski, Henry Rollins, Mike Watt, Brian Ritchie, Dean DeLeo, Flea, Grant Hart, and Dave Pernier offer informative anecdotes. Many who have been involved with the band in countless other ways in their career are also included. Joe Carducci, Joseph Cultus, Dave Markey, and Pete Anderson give their insights. There are many others: girlfriends, grunge rockers, childhood friends, other former band members, and more. What binds them together is that they are all meatheads, dedicated fans of the band. Prado covers all periods of Meat Puppet's career. He begins with the Phoenix, Arizona childhoods of brothers Kurt and Chris and their friend Derek, moves through the band's formation and integration into the Los Angeles punk scene, onto their recording relationship with SST Records, their move in the early 90s to the major label London Records, where they achieved their greatest commercial success, their classic rock drug-fueled crash and burn in the mid-90s, and their reemergence on the scene, strong as ever, in 2007. Along the way, Prado provides stories concerning all of the band's records, trippy tales from their incessant touring, their appearance with Nirvana, and an extended account of Chris's meltdown and reemergence. All in all, this is a book meatheads everywhere have been waiting for. It's the story of a majorly important band as told through the words of its peers. Greg Prado lives in Long Island, New York, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, Greg, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Hey, Matt. How's it going?
It's going well, thanks. All right, well, let's talk about your book about Meat Puppets. Well, before we get to that, why don't you tell us a little bit about your biography?
Sure. I'm from Long Island, New York, and I've been writing since about 1997. And I write for a few places, primarily Rolling Stone. I do things for them. And I'm also the author of several books. My first book came out a few years ago called Grunge is Dead, which is, my first book that came out was a book about Shannon Hoon from Blind Melon called A Devil on One Shoulder. And then shortly after that, I put out a book called Grunge is Dead, which is one of my more popular books. And I've done a total of 9 books so far. And earlier this year, I put out a book about the Meat Puppets, which is one of my favorite all-time bands. And I'm pretty happy with how it came out.
How did you get into writing about rock and roll? I know you write about some sports as well.
Yeah.
How did you get into writing about rock and roll?
Well, I've been a fan of rock music for as long as I can remember. I've always listened, and then I started listening to a wide variety of music as I got a little bit older. But the Meat Puppets were always a favorite band of mine. And besides the Meat Puppets, just as far as getting into writing, I took a job as a customer service rep a few years ago, back in 1997, and at a music magazine, and I saw how easy it was to write, so I just took the plunge. And at that point, that's when the internet was kind of booming, and I was able to get my foot in the door with a few places, and then I just took it from there, writing as a freelancer over the years, and then, like I said, a few years ago, taking the plunge with books, and that's pretty much how I got started as a writer.
Uh-huh. Before we get specifically into Meat Puppets, is it correct to say you've self-published this book? Tell us about Lulu.com a little bit.
Yeah, to me personally, it seems like the publishing industry is going the way of the dodo pretty much. It seems similar to how record companies just pretty much died a few years ago. The main publishers seem to be a little bit out of touch. Like, they still go by the old rules, like you need an agent to get through to them. And I've had a few experiences where they won't even listen to you because they only have a set number of authors that they're going to pretty much okay for their books. So I've tried in the past to get, I have 2 books that came out through an actual publisher called ECW Press. The one book is the book I mentioned before called Grunge is Dead, and my other book is called Sack Exchange, which came out about a year ago, which is about the 1980s New York Jets football team. But all my other books I've put out self-published because I just like to be in control of, you know, my creation sort of, you know, I have confidence in myself that I know what I'm doing and that, the final product will be, you know, good kind of. I pretty much every single book. Well, no, I could say definitely every single book I've done is on a subject that, I personally liked and I wanted to see a book written about that subject and there wasn't a book. So I'm lucky that I was able to just go out and get, you know, interviews with people about the certain subjects and everything and actually do those books. But, yeah, getting back to the self-publishing thing, I came across Lulu.com, through a news article, a while back. And, yeah, I'm pretty happy with, how they do their books. They're as good quality as the majority of the, professional published books. So I think they do a, you know, good job with that. And, yeah, I mean, to me, it's still a riddle how you, get through to these big publishers. I mean, I think you need an agent, but the agents I've dealt with so far haven't been very good. So who knows? I mean, personally, I think it's just a matter of time until most of the publishers are gone anyway, because with these, because by self-publishing, you, pretty much get your books on like Amazon.com and all these online sale places and bookstores, they're all pretty much dying as well. So pretty soon I think we're all really going to have things like Amazon.com. And if you don't need a major publisher to do that, what's the point of going to a major publisher and having to give them a cut of the sales and everything? You could just get it all yourself or get at least a bigger cut by doing it yourself through a self-publisher.
Right. I hope I can quote that line when you say, what do you call them? Bookstores?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, sad because I definitely did like to used to go to bookstores and just sit down and read books. I mean, the same with also record stores, you know, but yeah, it just seems like, you know, you just have to, you know, with the, you know, times they're changing and you have to adapt. So it seems like people are all about buying things online nowadays.
One more thing before we get specifically to the book, tell us a little bit about the genre that you've settled into a little bit of oral histories. How tell us about oral histories, please.
Yeah, I first discovered oral history books by a book called Please Kill Me, which came out in the mid to late 90s, which was about the 70s punk scene in New York with, you know, like CBGBs and bands like the Ramones and the Dead Boys and Blondie. And I found it to be a really great way to put a book together. Pretty much what it is for people that don't know what oral history is there'll be a chapter where there'll be a subject. Like say, for instance, with my Meat Puppets book, if the subject is when the Meat Puppets played with Nirvana, that'll be the subject. And then that whole chapter is all the people talking about their memories about playing the Nirvana Unplugged special, how they got in contact with Nirvana and all those types of things. So it's kind of like a book form of a film documentary is kind of how I like to look at it. And all my books so far have been in that format because I just like that the reader is getting the story straight from the horse's mouth and straight from people that were actually there. Before I was even a book author, the favorite type of writing I like to read in magazines like Rolling Stone and Spin were Q&As with people, you know, rather than an author giving their take on something when they weren't even there. You know, I just kind of like to have the actual definitive word, and I feel like you get that way the best by using the oral history format.
In what way does your voice, the author's voice, come through in an oral history?
Well, I mean, there's a few of my books where I have just an opening paragraph for each chapter just explaining what's going on. But I mean, as the author, I guess I'm, you could say like the director almost as like a film would be, that I'm interviewing the people, I'm coming up with the questions, I know I have to kind of make the chapters and also the story flow and make it also coherent. Because I mean, when you're speaking to people for books, you're not asking the same questions to each person. Each person is coming in at different times of the story. So it's really, I guess you could say, similar to a director or someone when they're making a film, a documentary. You know, you have all these Q&As with people, and then you have to edit it, and you have to put it, you know, according to the specific subjects that it's making store. It's making sense and that the story is flowing.
So let's get to the Meat Puppets book then. And just for a brief moment, sticking with the oral history part, how did you decide who to interview? And I imagine there are some people you weren't able to interview.
Yeah, for the most part, with this book, I was able to get a lot of people that we set out to get. I've been friendly with Kurt Kirkwood, the singer and guitarist for the band, for a while. I interviewed him a few years ago for Rolling Stone. We became friendly over the years. And I then got in contact with their manager, Dennis Pulowski. And I told him that I would like to do a book. And he said, sure. And, you know, I think I sent him maybe one of my other books. And he, you know, definitely dug that. And then they were a big help with putting me in contact with people, because Dennis, you know, has some very good contacts, you know, so he was able to put me in contact with a lot of people. That was nice. And then also, just for me being a writer for so long, I also had a lot of contacts with people too. So we kind of just pooled it together, and that's how we were able to come up with everyone. And off the top of my head, I can't really think of too many people or really anyone that we tried to get that we couldn't. I'm trying to think. Yeah, I mean, we were able to get a lot of pretty good names. Like, we were able to get Kim Thayil from Soundgarden, Flea from the Chili Peppers. Henry Rollins okayed a email, a Q&A, which was very nice of him. We were able to interview all of the Meat Puppets members. Well, I mean, not all. There was a brief period in the early 2000s where there were a few members that I didn't speak to, because that was just like a brief version of the band. But I was able to interview the 80s version of the band, which is considered the classic version. And I was able to also interview Derek Bostrom, who was the original Meat Puppets drummer, who hasn't been in the band since 1995, so that was good to be able to speak to him. But, yeah, I mean, I think we definitely nailed it with getting the definitive story of the band.
Get into the definitive story of the band. The band, starting with what you call the classic version, then, is Kurt Kirkwood, his brother Chris, and Derek. Tell us. We'll try and go kind of in the order of your book if we can. So
sure.
Maybe a little bit of their early life and how do they get together as a band?
Well, they're originally from Arizona, Phoenix, I believe. And there's a pretty, you know, if you read the book, the Kirkwood's early years are really crazy. That could be just like a book in itself. They came from a divorced household, and their mother was, you know, very, very kind and nice, but seems like she had a problem with some of the people or some of her subsequent husbands and boyfriends. There was one guy that had a drinking problem that wound up setting their like house on fire or something, which is crazy. And all that. And, you know, I think it was Kurt or Chris says that type of stuff definitely affected the way that they grew up and even some of their music, you could say. But they met Derek in the late 70s through, I think, mutual friends. And they were all into, before they met Derek, I think they were into pretty much like classic rock and fusion and stuff. And maybe a little bit of punk rock, but it wasn't until they met Derek that Derek turned them on to all the great punk rock bands of the day, like the Germs and Black Flag and the Stooges and things like that. And that's how they formed their union and eventually formed the Meat Puppets in about 1980.
Do you know before they start to record?
I don't know. Can you just repeat that? It broke up a little bit.
Sorry. How long were they together, do you know, before they started to record?
I think they started to do demos pretty much straight away. Their first album came out, I believe it was in 1982. And actually, I take that back. They put out a EP called In a Car, which came out, I believe, in 1981. And their first album came out in 82, just called Meat Puppets. So it was probably just a few months before they started demoing. And I think they started playing shows pretty much right away. And originally, the drummer, Derek, was the main songwriter. But shortly thereafter, Kirkwood became the main songwriter and singer, and that's when the Meat Puppets sound, as we know it, started to get solidified.
So their first full-length record is on SST Records. Tell us a bit about SST Records, please.
Yeah, SST Records was created by the band Black Flag. And they went on to become one of the top indie rock labels of the 80s and pretty much beyond. It's really, really impressive the bands they've had on their label throughout the years. They put out bands like the Minutemen, Bad Brains, Soundgarden, of course, also Black Flag, and also the Meat Puppets, too. So it's very impressive the roster and also the talent that they were able to, you know, find and things like, you know, in the book, someone says that Greg Ginn, who was the Black Flag guitarist, was one of the best A&R people that they've pretty much ever seen, because, you know, his, besides being a guitarist and everything, he was able to spot bands that would go on to become great bands. So he was definitely a big part of that label.
I think Husker Du, did you say Husker Du? I think they put out a record or two.
Yeah. Skipped Husker Du. So yeah, that's also a great band that they were able to put some albums out as well.
Did you get any information about how did Meat Puppets come in contact with SST?
The Meat Puppets played a show or two with Black Flag, and I believe it was Chuck Dukowski, their bass player, or it was Greg, approached the band and said, you know, we should, you know, possibly work together. And then they were able to get together, and the Meat Puppets put out albums through SST up till, I think the last one was 1989. So it was throughout the whole entire 80s that they put out albums together. And then in the early 90s, the Meat Puppets made the jump to a major label with London Records.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to some of their earlier records, though.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, the first record has a lot of Derek on it, Derek Bostrom, the drummer. And then moving into the second one, which is considered, you know, by many of people like you, rock critics and stuff, to be a classic record.
Yeah.
And many people do say this, that there's a real jump, a difference between those first two records. Can you talk to that subject a little bit, the difference between the first record and the second record?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge, just by listening to all these bands throughout the years, I can't think of another band that made such a big jump as the Meat Puppets between the first and second album. The first album was very noisy. It almost sounds like some of the songs weren't even written beforehand. But I did find out that they actually were written beforehand. It's just that's the sound that they wanted, and I believe they also did acid or like LSD or something prior to the recording, so that I guess may have also contributed to how it came out like a very noisy record. But the second album, which came out, which was recorded in 1983 but didn't come out until 1984 for some reason, it was a merger of punk rock and also country music, and that to me is definitely a groundbreaking album. When you think of also when it came out in 1984, you know, like what was popular at that time as far as rock bands, you know, if you put on MTV, you'd see Van Halen and like, you know, Motley Crue and things like that. It's a very bold, original thing and also besides the fact that punk fans, I think, didn't know what the hell to make of that style of music in the book, the Kirkwood Brothers talk about opening up for a Black Flag in 1984 and trying to play that stuff for a Black Flag audience and just getting pelted with trash and just not being treated very kindly. And that to me is probably my favorite Meat Puppets album. I know it was a huge influence on Kurt Cobain, because he went on to cover three of those songs on Nirvana's Unplugged in 1993. So, to me, and I also discovered that album by reading an interview with Kim Thayil from Soundgarden in about 1989 in a magazine called Rip, which is no longer around. I was reading an article because I was such a big Soundgarden fan, and he talked about a bunch of bands and albums that he suggested people should check out, and that was one of them, and I eventually did check out a Meat Puppets album and was blown away.
It seems almost like a Meat Puppets were kind of the victims of historical circumstance, because, you know, I get the feeling in the book and other things I've read that they've never really considered themselves to be punk rockers, but they kind of, you know, they just got kind of thrown in to this scene.
Yeah, I mean, something I've always loved about the Meat Puppets is they're one of the few bands that never shy away from any style. If they want to write like a jazz song, they'll do a jazz song. If they want to do a country song, they'll do a country song. If they want to do like a heavy metal song, they'll do that. There's really, just about every single style of music, you know, and that's also what Chris Kirkwood says, is that to him, music was just music, that, you know, there should be no boundaries, everything, you know, and that to me, I think, even reflects how I listen to music today. I listen to pretty much everything at this point. And, you know, again, that doesn't really translate well to like, you know, every single band, but I definitely think it translated well to the Meat Puppets. And that I think became their trademark too, that they could handle just about like any, you know, style put in front of them. And if you look at the wide variety of bands they've also played with over the years, that also covers a lot of ground as well.
You know the industry, and how do you think that this approach of theirs has affected their commercial success? This, you know, they'll play anything, and doesn't that make it difficult to, from a marketing perspective?
Well, I don't think it really did, because their biggest album was in 1994 called Too High to Die. And, you know, that album was that had a wide variety of songs, and that went on to be a gold selling record. And, you know, and we also just discussed the second Meat Puppets album that has, you know, country music, punk music, folk music. It has like several different styles. You know, there's bands like David Bowie, Neil Young. They've done a wide variety of different styles, and they were able to attract a large audience. You know, like I was saying before, some bands can pull it off. Some, you know, some bands, their audience can handle, you know, a pretty big wide variety of styles. And then there's other bands that have a following that just want them to, you know, hone in on one style and just keep at it. You know, so the Meat Puppets are lucky that they were able to attract an audience like that.
You've already kind of touched on this, but you devote an entire chapter with an interview with Kim Thiel. What is your thinking around that?
Well, I became friendly with Kim when I interviewed him for my book called Grunge is Dead, which came out a few years ago. And after interviewing him, we remain in contact and we've become friends over the years. And yeah, I interviewed him for the book because, like I said before, I originally discovered the Meat Puppets by reading a thing that he did in Rip magazine talking about how the Meat Puppets 2 was one of the best albums and you should check it out. But that wasn't the first album I checked out of theirs. The first album was Forbidden Places, which I happened to buy because I belonged to a CD club at the time. And that was the only Meat Puppets album. And that's how I got into that. But yeah, but getting back to Kim in the book, he when I was interviewing him for the book, it turns out that really the first album is his favorite Meat Puppets album. And he told me a pretty long but interesting story about how he discovered it, how he was a DJ at the time for his college radio station. And he at first didn't like the album and pretty much trashed it. He gave it like a low rating. And then later it slowly grew on him. And it was actually Ben Shepherd's brother, Ben Shepherd being Soundgarden's current bassist. Ben Shepherd's brother, Kim, roomed with at the time. And it was him. His name is Henry Shepherd, I believe, told Kim, no, you know, you should give that a second listen. It's actually a pretty good album. And that's how he gave it a second chance and listened to it a bunch of times. And he said that became one of his top albums. I'm pretty sure that's one of his favorite albums of all time, if I'm not mistaken.
So it seems like one of the angles in your book is your maybe this is back to the people you had access to, but it seems one of your main angles is Meat Puppet's influence on grunge and alternative from the early 90s. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, definitely they were a pretty big influence. If you hear bands like Nirvana and also Soundgarden, even a band like the Stone Temple Pilots has gone on to say how much they love the Meat Puppets, and they've toured with them a bunch of times. I mean, the Meat Puppets, you know, again, it's hard to pin them down to one sound, but it seems like the bands from Seattle from the early 90s were all pretty big fans of the Meat Puppets. Like, I know the guys from Mudhoney were big fans of them. I interviewed Mark Arm for the book. And, for some reason, it just seems like those grunge bands, I guess, found, you know, stuff about the Meat Puppets that they could use for their own sound.
With especially those two records, Too High to Die and then next No Joke, mm-hmm. Kurt and Meat Puppets were conscious of the grunge scene, and they were willing to make, as willing as Meat Puppets are, to make a grunge sounding record. Do you think so?
Yeah, I think definitely, because if you listen to in the late 80s, well, actually mid to late 80s, they shifted from being like a raw punk band then to they started experimenting with synthesizer guitar and also electronic drums, which I personally love those albums. It's not like that they were trying to sell out to try to get on radio or anything. It's just that that's happened to be the type of technology that they were able to put their hands on, and they incorporated it into their sound. And then by the by 1991, the album Forbidden Places, they went back a little bit more to their country roots a bit. So I guess it just made sense in 1993, you know, with Nirvana and everything so popular, that they went back to kind of like the raw sound of their early albums. But it was a bit more produced, even though it was produced by the guitarist of Butthole Surfers. So it wasn't like they're working with Mutt Lange or someone like that. And yeah, so I guess it was a conscious, you know, decision to do that. But I personally, I think that that Too High to Die album is one of my favorite Meat Puppets albums. I think the sound of it, the performance, the songs, everything, I think that's one of the strongest Meat Puppets albums.
Go back again to the early 80s. They were on SST, and Black Flag, of course, were, trailblazers, creating a whole, you know, touring circuit for indie rock bands. Talk about the Meat Puppets early touring days, and maybe tell some stories from your books from the early days.
Yeah, well, I think I'm trying to give a really good story of the early tours. Well, it was a lot. There's some stories about, you know, something that you don't really keep in, or that something that a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of these bands at the time had to be driving their own vans and everything like that. And there were certain, there were actually several times, I believe, that either due to maybe too much smoking pot or maybe just being too tired after a show, there were one or two times where they almost got into horrible, car crashes, or I guess actually like, you know, van crashes and things like that. So there's like one or two stories about that, how Kurt, I think, once drove off a road and like at the last second swerved back and he was headed for a tree or something. And there's also a very colorful story that Chris tells about him. Again, I think he was on acid or something, and they were touring in New York City, and they went to a campground on Long Island to spend the night. And at the time they were touring in a RV, I believe. And he was so like out of it, he didn't know what he was doing, and he was emptying out, I guess, to empty out the van's septic tank or whatever. You take a big tube or something like a hose out of the van, and you put it into the ground, and then it just like empties out. And he didn't realize that the hole that he was emptying out into was, I guess, like full already, and it started completely like overflowing, and he didn't know what it was exactly because he was so stoned. He thought it was like a big blob or something. And it was, so I think at like the last minute they were able to pull it out, and just they packed up everything and sped off before people could realize what the hell they were doing, because it was also right by, I think Chris could see that it was overflowing so much that the stuff from the septic tank was, it was like a big blob that would just kept growing bigger and bigger, and actually went towards people's tents that were camped out. I think it even may have like somehow like went into the tents. People obviously weren't very pleased when they woke up being engulfed in all that disgusting gunk and junk. So they were able to speed off after that, and I guess they wound up never getting caught.
End of that story was Chris is saying that now somebody else has a story to tell about the time they were camping and fluorescent doo-doo came into their tents.
Right, exactly. Right, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the Meat Puppets as a live act. I think there's a difference between, quite a bit of difference between their recordings, and they built their reputation really live, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I would think so. Definitely touring, because, I mean, in the 80s, you know, MTV and radio weren't playing bands that were on SST records, are really playing like any of those bands that were like, you know, underground at the time. So pretty much the only thing those bands could do was just tour and tour and tour. So that's what the Meat Puppets did. And yeah, if you listen to the bootlegs, and also they put out, I think, one or two live albums later on, actually, you know, from that era, but it was released maybe about 10 or 20 years after the fact. Yeah, it was, you couldn't tell what the Meat Puppets were going to do that night. Either they would jam wildly, or they would throw in weird covers, or they'd come out dressed in all weird costumes, you know, which I think is great. That's the complete opposite of, like, you know, a show from these big bands that are playing stadiums, where it's a set list and set, you know, costumes and choreography. This is something completely different. You know, definitely back to the early days of rock. And, Yeah, they I definitely were one of the more daring live bands, especially when you think, like I mentioned before, when they would open for bands like Black Flag, and they'd come out and do, you know, these like long country jams, and they would do Grateful Dead covers and all these other weird covers. Like they would cover a song from, I think, The King and I and things like that. And I know they'd cover Everly Brothers songs. It's like they would do things just to pretty much piss off the audience, which I personally think is great because I'm a big fan of what's his name, Andy Kaufman. And his type of comedy seemed like he would try to piss off the audience. So I'm always a big fan of people that are daring and you know, try to get a reaction out of the audience a bit.
So now, what about The Move? Again, it seems like a pretty different records. If you go from Meat Puppets to their next one, Up on the Sun, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I would say that Meat Puppets 2 and also Up on the Sun are probably my two favorite albums of theirs. And for Up on the Sun, they wanted to make a psychedelic record. So suddenly they shift gears from country now to a psychedelic kind of like mellow album. And the singing is maybe a little bit, I was going to say tuneful, but one of the Meat Puppets' trademarks, especially in the 80s, was vocals that were not in tune. I mean, not they were completely out of tune, but they were, you know, not like right. I mean, especially now with all this like, you know, auto-tune stuff, it was definitely different from that. And it's a more trippy record. The title track is probably one of their most famous songs, or at least popular with their fan base. That's like a mellow sound. I mean, it's kind of hard to even explain what it sounds like. If you picture maybe the Grateful Dead as like a punk band or something, or a punk band maybe very stoned, or, you know, it's the complete opposite of the first album, where it's just complete noise and very violent. This is more mellow and kind of like, you know, laid back sort of.
You've made this connection now once or twice, and I know Kurt Kirkwood is, and Chris, maybe Derek as well, were always fans of the Grateful Dead. Don't you think you can see it in their music and their live shows as well, Meat Puppets and the Grateful Dead connection?
Yeah, the Grateful Dead, and also Neil Young, I see quite a bit of a connection there as well. Yeah, with the jamming and stuff, they would often do jamming and yeah, no, that also Chris Kirkwood says that Phil Lesh was one of his top bass influences. And you could definitely hear that in some of his playing. But yeah, Kurt Kirkwood is also, I think, one of rock's most underrated guitarists. There's even a chapter in the book which, you know, people just talk about how he's a you know, great guitarist. And how, you know, you put any style in front of him and he can, you know, pretty much pull it off great. So, yeah, I think it's just a testament to how the Meat Puppets are very underrated players on their instruments.
I don't know if you've seen them recently, but, you know, now maybe more than ever, you know, they're just like the Dead. They're willing to completely deconstruct, you know, any structure on any of their songs sometimes.
Yeah.
These long, long jams.
Yeah, actually, I was lucky to see them last year, and I can honestly say that they're as good a live band now, maybe even better than when I. The first time that I ever saw them live was in 1995 on the No Joke tour, and that was when Chris Kirkwood was bad off with drugs. He, as people will learn in the book, he got very badly addicted to heroin in the 90s and also early 2000s, and went through some really horrible ordeals in his life. Wound up going to jail for a while. Wound up getting shot too and almost killed. But that was the beginning of his, you know, I guess, bad period. And, the show I saw in 1995 wasn't together at all. And it seemed like that they weren't on the same page. And, it, you know, I would see videos of them and things of them playing live and it was just fantastic. And then I saw that show and I was kind of let down. But, when I saw them last year, it was as good as those old videos you see of them. You know, it was definitely inspired. It was very tight. Great, great set list. And, I think that their singing and also harmonies now are better than I would say ever. And Kurt and Chris are still great players. And their drummer now, Shandon Somm, is a great, great, player too. I think he's, a fine, addition to the band as well. And they also have, Kurt's, son, Elmo playing second guitar. So it's even a heavier, fuller sound now. So. Yeah, I would highly recommend if the Meat Puppets come around to a town near you to check them out. They're definitely a great live act.
Do you think I'm playing off chapter 10 now. Do you think the Kirkwoods and Derek, especially in the early days, they see themselves as artists beyond being musicians?
Yeah, that's the thing that I know that they were also all involved in art and drawing and also cartoon work. I know that there's some talk in there where Kurt talks about how he is really into all these different cartoonists and also all these other people. And Chris also is a very good artist himself. I know that he has done paintings and he also draws little doodles for fans when they ask and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, they were artists, I think, in the purest sense of the word, whether it was drawing, music. You know, I think that they definitely respected arts. They definitely respected art of all kinds.
On album covers, right? The paintings on the albums.
Yeah. And also Kurt did a lot of those album covers, including the best known ones like Meat Puppets 2 and also Up on the Sun. And Derek did Mirage. And I know Chris did the inside artwork of Too High to Die. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they've all contributed artwork over the years. And I know some of Chris's drawings, I believe, have become T-shirt designs as well for the band.
So what comes next? Out My Way, I think, comes after Up on the Sun. Tell us just a little bit about Out My Way.
Yeah, that was a EP. And what happened was Kurt Kirkwood broke his finger. Someone closed the van door on his finger, I believe. So I think they had different plans for that, and it just wound up becoming a EP. And I think it's personally a really great album still. I mean, I'm pretty much a fan. I can honestly say the Meat Puppets never put out a bad album. Each one of their albums has something unique about it. And that one, songwriting got a little more refined, perhaps. That may be one of their more focused albums as far as the songwriting. But I think it was a good place to go from the previous album, Up on the Sun.
My introduction to Meat Puppets was hearing Good Golly, Miss Molly on a radio show in San Diego once. And I was like, that's a very cool cover.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that just shows how they can cover just about like any, you know, song and do a great version of it. Like I said, I heard once there's a album they put out a few years ago called Live in Montana, which was recorded, I think, in 1988, and they do a pretty good version of I take it back. This may have just been a bootleg. I think I heard them do All I Have to Do Is Dream by the Everly Brothers, and it was really great. That's probably one of my favorite covers of them. But on that album, Alive in Montana, they cover like Sweet Leaf. They cover a song called Small Hours, which I think is like an old punk song or new wave song, which then Metallica would cover later. And they do several other songs on that.
Woody Guthrie.
Pardon me, what's that?
They do Woody Guthrie. They do Do Re Mi, right?
Yes, yeah, that. And they also do a song called Sandman's Coming or something, which I'm not even sure what that's from, but that's it was called Cotton Candyland. That's that song they do on that.
In putting that record together, I think they were probably trying to show the variety of what they can do.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's a good album showing them at the time that, they could do covers and also their own songs and tie it all together with jams and things like that.
So do you find the Meat Puppets to be good interviews when you talk with them?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. They were very, very open. I mean, Kurt was very open. Chris, you know, they were all – they definitely didn't hold things back. And I could – you know, and part of the agreement we came with is, you know, I told them, look, just be honest about everything. Tell me everything that you want. I'll just make this book. Then I'll show it to you. You read it. If there's anything you're not comfortable with, I'll take it out. But, you know, you might as well just, you know, tell me everything. And that's what they did. And I can tell you honestly, they didn't tell me to take one single thing out. They just were like, no, leave everything in there. We mm-hmm. want it to be a true, you know, story of us. So I have to give them credit that they did that, you know, especially Chris during his period with, you know, drugs, and he wound up losing his wife to drugs and he got shot. You know, he could have just said, no, I don't want to talk about that. That's a very dark period of my life. But he was willing to go on record with that. And I think, not mistaken, that's probably the first time he's ever really discussed that time of his life in such great detail. I mean, I know he's probably discussed that a bit, but I know, you know, this was the first time he sat down and really, you know, talked a lot about what it was like being in jail and finally getting off drugs and reconnecting with Kurt, because Kurt and Chris didn't talk for almost about 10 years due to that whole thing, because Chris was, you know, pretty much wild and just doing crazy stuff, and Kurt, you know, didn't want to get, you know, dragged down with him, so he had to kind of cut him off for a while there.
You put Mirage and Huevos into one chapter. How? Why do they only? Why do they get combined?
Because I believe they were recorded together at the same time, and they're kind of like a brother or a sister album, sort of. So I think that it just made sense to kind of put those both together.
Are those the two that came out? I think they came out in the same year, didn't they?
Yeah, and I was going to say, and also they both came out in the year 1987. So I would say Mirage is probably the Meat Puppets' most underrated album. People tend to write it off because there's a lot of, like, there's guitar synthesizer on it. There's also electronic drums. But I think the songwriting is great. I think the songs are very interesting. The performances are great. I think that's an album that I always liked, but by doing this book, I went back and listened to it again, and I definitely was able to see it in a whole different light. And that's a album that people should go back and give a second chance. I think they'd probably like it.
It's a little bit more of a straightforward rocker, right?
A little bit, but I mean, it's, you know, not like hard rock, I wouldn't say. It's definitely not one of the more hard rock albums, because it's all, you know, not like heavy guitar and things like that. So it's maybe, I wouldn't say their most like new wavy album, but maybe their most experimental album, you could say.
Huevos?
I'm a very big fan of that album. That was influenced a lot by ZZ Top, which is one of their big influences as well. Yeah, besides the Grateful Dead, ZZ Top is one of their top influences as well. And you can definitely hear it in that album, Huevos. There's a lot of Billy Gibbons type guitar riffs and also guitar playing on that.
Yeah, that's what I was suggesting earlier. I might have misspoke. That Huevos is a more of a straight ahead rock album than Mirage.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. I would say Huevos is one of their straight ahead rock albums. And, it just shows how they can switch, that they could change, you know, like, you know, gears like that, and they could still be on the top of their game, you know, doing a very experimental album with all these like synthesizers, and they go back to, a ZZ Top, you know, rocking album. Definitely shows that they can pull off just about anything.
Mm-hmm. So next comes, Monsters, and this is going to be their last SST record.
Right.
But even there was some conflict with the band and this record and SST Records. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, sure. And something else which I learned from this, from doing this book, which I found very, very funny and also very interesting, was that album always had a strange sound to it to me, because it's hard rock, but it's also electronic drums. So it's, that album may be a merger between Huevos and also Mirage. But when I asked Kurt about that album, he said he was listening to a lot of Def Leppard at that time, and that he actually set out with that album to record a Def Leppard sounding album. When I went back and listened to it, suddenly it all completely made sense that that's what it was. So I find that to be pretty interesting. And, you know, and again, that just goes back to how the Meat Puppets were always very daring, and they also didn't care less about, you know, different types of musical categories. They're willing to listen to anything and let it seep into their own sound. So that's something that I think is, you know, should definitely be commended by them. And yeah, as far as that album, they were, I think, offered a record contract with Atlantic Records, and they said that Greg Ginn from SST, for whatever reason, didn't want them to leave SST, so he pretty much killed that deal. And there was all, like, there was then a big battle between the Meat Puppets and also the label. Eventually, they put out that album through SST, and that was their last studio album. And then they eventually got off that label. And Kurt says that he was lucky, because they were able to come to an agreement that eventually he got all the rights back to all those 80s albums. And that was right around the time that they did the Nirvana appearance. And that was also right around the time that they reissued all those albums on Rykodisc. So it was, you know, for them, it just turned out a very, very lucky thing that they got all the rights to their albums back, because they were able to make a lot more revenue, you know, from when suddenly they had a lot of attention from their Nirvana connection.
make the so after Monsters, they do get to London Records, which is a major label right. in all respects, and they make Forbidden Places with Pete Anderson, who is kind of a at the time a big name. You've already said a little bit, but say a little more, please, about Forbidden Places.
Yeah, Pete Anderson is associated quite often with Dwight Yoakam, who's obviously a very famous country singer. And, yeah, he had a bit of a influence on that album, but it's not a straight country album. There's definitely some, you know, rockin' things on that. That was, like I said before, that was the first album I personally ever heard of theirs, and I was blown away by it. And that was, it's not a grungy type album, but I heard it right in the middle of listening to grunge music, and I could tell that that was a great album. And it really didn't sound like much at the time. The songwriting is really good on that album. I think that's when also Kurt Kirkwood's vocals started to really mature, and that's when he started to become a really good singer. As far as a traditional singer, I mean, because I always did like his singing. I always thought his singing fit the songs really well throughout all their albums, but that was when it became more, like he became more of a traditional good singer, I think. So, yeah, that's a good album. That's a album, too, that a lot of people tend to overlook. That's a album people should give a second listen to as well.
And I don't think it commercially it pretty much flopped.
Yeah, it didn't really do much, and which is a shame because I think that's one of the stronger albums, song for song. You know, there's definitely some great songs in that could have been played on radio. You know, but just for whatever reason, it just fell through the cracks.
In Chicago at the time, and they did play Sam a little bit on the radio. But that was the only one I think I ever heard.
Yeah, I have a friend who said I think he saw the video played once or twice on like 120 minutes at the time.
Now we get into their commercial success. It's between Forbidden Places and Two Eye to Die that the connection between Meat Puppets and Nirvana takes place, right?
Yes.
So tell us how that occurs.
Yeah, Kurt Cobain was always a big fan of the band, and he invited them to open up for them on a few dates on the In Utero tour, which went on to be Nirvana's last tour ever. And they didn't open up the whole tour. They opened up maybe like a week or two, I believe. And during that time was when Nirvana was offered the MTV Unplugged appearance. And he wanted to cover one or two Meat Puppets songs, but they were having a hard time figuring it out. So Kirk Kirkwood was just like, hey, why don't I just come on? You know, actually him and Chris, why don't me and my brother just come on and we'll just play them and you can sing them? And that's what they wound up doing. And instead of just one song, they wound up doing three songs. And that's probably what the Meat Puppets are best known for, is their MTV Unplugged appearance with Nirvana, which I think by far is the best Unplugged performance ever by like any band. I think that's the best one. And, you know, again, they were just lucky to be there at the right place at the right time.
Maybe because Forbidden Places and Nevermind come out like within a month of each other. I can't remember which comes out first. I think maybe Forbidden Places comes out first.
Yeah.
But I think that might, in my mind, be one of the reasons that Forbidden Places tanks, because once Nevermind comes out, everything before it is pretty much, you know, put in the dustbin.
I mean, I would say with that yes and no, because 1991 there, you know, that's when, like, for instance, Primus put out Sailing the Seas of Cheese, and that was a pretty big album for them. That came out in the spring of 91, I believe. You know, it's like they're like certain band, you know, and also Jane's Addiction was still, they broke up at the end of 91. So they put out Ritual de lo Habitual in 1990. So yes, that's 1990. That's not 1991. But I mean, certain bands, I think, were still thriving that weren't straight ahead grunge. You know, Smashing Pumpkins put out Gish around that time. They're not really like a straight grunge band. And also Nine Inch Nails was still, you know, kind of coming up at that point. So I wouldn't say that every band, just because grunge got popular, took a hit. You know, certain bands, like I said, Primus was able to, you know, still become very, very, very popular after grunge became, you know, the hip type of rock music to listen to for the mainstream.
So then Two Eye to Die, and that, as you said, is their best-selling record. It went gold. And you say it may be your favorite. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I would definitely put that in my top five. It's a pretty raw album, which I think is pretty impressive, because I think the label was probably putting pressure on the Meat Puppets to succeed with this album, which they obviously did with the song Backwater. they hooked up with their friend from Butthole Surfers, Paul Leary, the guitarist who was getting involved in producing albums at that point. And he did a really good job keeping the sound very raw. But again, it was the songwriting. You know, again, Kurt Kirkwood always seems to rise to the occasion with coming up with great albums worth of songs. You know, he came up with some really, really great songs in that, like a song called Violet Eyes, which Scott Ashton from The Stooges says is one of his favorite Meat Puppet songs ever. And, yeah, I think that that was, you know, again, they just happened to hit a home run when they, you know, pretty much, you know, I guess at that point needed to if they wanted to stay on a major label. And that album, because of Kurt Cobain committing suicide, they MTV started playing the MTV Unplugged special over and over again. And that's right when they Meat Puppets put out the Backwater video and song, and that became a big hit. And then the Meat Puppets were able to get a tour with Stone Temple Pilots that were very, very popular at the time. So just in that year alone, that's what really brought the Meat Puppets to the masses.
You devote two chapters to the year 1994. What's important about that year?
Yeah, I mean, that to me was probably the Meat Puppets' craziest, busiest year because there was just so much going on between success and tours and putting out the album and also Kurt Cobain dying. I mean, that was a year of a lot of like weird stuff going on. And also that was the beginning of the end for the band, because that was when it was during the Stone Temple Pilots tour that Chris became pretty bad off with heroin. So although they were having all this great success, you know, and people from the outside, you know, like for instance, me as a fan at the time, I just figured, oh, well, this is great. This is, you know, they finally scored their big breakthrough. This will put them over the top. Their next album will probably sell more. And, you know, in 2 or 3 years, they'll be headlining arenas and stuff themselves. But it just didn't happen that way because Chris kind of just self-destructed. They were able to put out one more album, but it just was never really the same. And the record label pulled the plug on supporting them. And then by 1996, the band was done.
Interesting. They added the second guitarist, Troy Mice. Is it pronounced Mice?
Yes.
And according to Troy, I mean, Chris was just completely abusive to him. Why do you suppose Chris obviously resented Troy being in the band?
I don't really know exactly what was going on, but yeah, I mean, from what Troy says, that was, you know, his side of the story. And I don't know, I mean, being bad off with drugs and everything, you know, that may have had something to do with it with Chris. Because I've met Chris once or twice, and he's always been a very kind, nice guy. And I've spoken to him several times on the phone. He's always been very cool on the phone. So, I don't know, maybe just like that, and maybe just the pressures of being on the road, and the fact that they didn't – that was the first time that it was not just the Kirkwood brothers and also Derek. That was the first time they brought a outsider in to their, you know, band. So maybe that had something to do with it. It was probably like a combination of like, you know, several things. Maybe Chris wanted, or maybe Chris felt that by bringing in a fourth person, maybe his, you know, suggestions wouldn't be maybe heard as much, or, you know, songwriting and stuff like that. I'm not really too sure exactly with that, why, you know, that type of thing happened between Troy and Chris.
I think one of the things that comes out really nice in your book is this relationship between Kurt and Chris. And I'm wondering if maybe, you know, Troy was, you know, Chris saw that as a bit of a threat to their brother relationship, maybe.
I don't know, can you just repeat that? Because the question just broke up a little bit.
One of the nice things that comes out in your book, I think, is the relationship between Kurt and Chris as brothers.
Right.
I'm wondering if Troy coming into the band, at least Chris might have seen that as a bit of a threat to that relationship.
Possible. I think that's what even Troy says in the book. I think he says that Chris may have felt a little threatened or something. But then he says, but, you know, it was Kurt who invited Troy in the band. It's not like that he, you know, weaseled his way in the band or anything. And he was also friends with the band for quite some time before he was asked to join. He, I think, first met them in 87 or 88. He saw them play, I think, in St. Louis, and became friends with them. And they, you know, would hang out throughout the years. And they became friends, and he also roadied for the band called the Feelies. That's how I think they discovered that he was involved in music himself. And yeah, it just seemed like a good fit at the time for them, for him to join.
So, the band kind of comes to a halt after No Joke. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, tell briefly a little bit about No Joke. How do you like that record?
Yeah, I actually love that album when it came out, and I've gone back to it and listened to it from time to time, and there is some great stuff on that. But like Derek says in the book, the songs are maybe a little bit more planned out. The performances aren't as natural as or like organic sounding as they were on the Too High to Die album. It seemed like maybe a little bit more stiff, you could say. But again, I think there's some really, really great songs on that. I think that's an album that a lot of people overlook, too. When that album came out, when I first heard it, I thought that was going to be another really big seller. But again, like as I talk in the book, London Records, I think, saw what was going on with Chris and just decided that they weren't going to put a lot of push behind it, and they didn't really promote it. And, yeah, the album never really got the attention that I think it deserved.
Have No Joke, when I listen to it, it seems to reflect the times of the band a little bit. It seems like a darker album thematically.
Yeah, definitely. There is definitely some darker type thing. Yeah, that's also what I think Derek mentions, too, that there's some dark kind of there's like a dark feel to it. Yeah, because at the time when that album was being written, Kurt and Chris's mother was dying from cancer. So that, I think, probably affected the Kirkwood's mindset at the time and also the songwriting. But, you know, again, I think it was a great album, and it definitely shows a, you know, time of the band that, you know, was dark and there's, you know, some bad stuff going on, but they were able to capture it on an album.
After No Joke, Chris goes into his heroin addiction, which gets pretty dark. He goes to jail. Derek kind of gets a straight kind of life. What does Kurt do during these? It's like 10 or 12 years, right, where they're kind of not a band.
Yeah, I think it was probably about like 10 years, I think. And, yeah, Kurt never really gave up playing. He put out he did a very good side band that I've always liked. Well, it wasn't a side band. It was actually a full-time band called Eyes Adrift with the drummer from Sublime. And also Chris from Nirvana on bass, which I think that album is great. That's also an album that I think not a lot of people have heard or have given it a chance. And it was, for some reason, not really well received in the press, but I always thought that was a great album. It's a self-titled album that came out, I think, in 2000, if I'm not mistaken. But prior to that, Kurt tried to carry on. He was in a band, it was titled the Royal Neanderthal Orchestra. And then, in order for them to get an album out, they had to name it Meat Puppets again, even though Kurt was the only, band member that people would even like and recognize from the classic lineup, because Derek wasn't in it and also Chris wasn't in it. So they put out one album, around, I think it was 1999, they put out an album, which may be their weakest album, but it has some pretty good things on it. You know, again, I don't think there's ever been a Meat Puppets album that's just been a complete horrible album. You know, there's some good things on it. The album's called Golden Lies. And then also Kurt put out a solo album, I think, after Eyes Adrift called Snow, which I also like. That's like a mellow, acoustic, folky type album. So, yeah, he kept...
It was with Pete Anderson, too, right?
Yes, that he got back together with... on that album, and that's also an album that I think is very underrated. When I interviewed Dean DeLeo from the Stone Temple Pilots for the book, he talked about how much he loves that album, and that's like a beautiful album. And yeah, that's an album I think that a lot of people should go back and give a second chance. They'd probably enjoy.
Back, they've been back together since 2007.
Yes.
How did the get together come about?
Well, when Chris got out of jail, he was clean and sober, and slowly Kurt and Chris got back together again. And then I guess with their relationship that, you know, kind of healed, then they were able to start talking music again. And they started they got back together with a drummer who was a fan of theirs named Ted Marcus, who I also interviewed for the book. And they did a couple of albums with him called Rise to Your Knees and also Sewn Together. And then after that, they got another drummer named Shannon Somm, who played on the album Golden Lies back in 1999. And I think that the lineup now with the Meat Puppets is definitely a great lineup, and I think Shannon brings a lot to the band. I think his drumming is a little bit different than Derek's. He's more of like a hard rock drummer, but he really adds a lot to the band. And I think I just think that they've done the right thing. I mean, like I was saying before, when I saw them last year, they're as good. Well, they're obviously better now than they were when I saw them back in 1995. I think that they put on a great show, and I think with also Shannon in the band, they are definitely on the right track. And I'm curious to hear what they're going to do with their next album, which, from what I heard, they just finished recording. And also, I forgot to mention, they put out an album with Shannon in 2011 called Lollipop, which that also is a great album. I think that if people listening to this that know the Meat Puppets a little bit and haven't heard that album, they should definitely check out that album. That's, I think, one of their best albums ever. And it just came out in 2011. So that just shows that they're still putting out great music, you know, which isn't the case with bands that have been been around for so long. But the Meat Puppets are still putting out good, vibrant music. So that's, it shows how, just the type of band they are.
To kind of start wrapping things up, where do you think Meat Puppets stand in the history of rock? And are we going to be thinking about them 50 years from now? And where do you see Kurt, because he's the main songwriter, where do you see Kurt as an artist and a songwriter? So there's a few questions in there.
Right. Well, yeah, one of the main reasons also why I did this book is I thought the Meat Puppets never get the credit that they deserve. So, and also I've always just wanted to read a book about them. So that's why I set out to do this book. But yeah, I mean, hopefully this book, if it, I'm sure fans will enjoy it, but if it could bring attention, you know, and maybe get them some new fans, that would be great. As far as the future, I would like to think that the Meat Puppets now are just going to keep on putting out albums and touring, because I think that now they're hitting a pretty good stride right now, and I think the next album should be really good. Because like I said, that last album, Lollipop, was very good, and also the concert I saw was great. So I'm curious to see them again, curious to see where they're going to go from here. And it's also good to see that Kurt and Chris now are, back as, they're, friends, besides also being brothers again. And that Chris is doing well and has his life straightened out. So, yeah, I think the band's in a pretty good place, and it definitely, I think, bodes well for the future.
Greg, I know you just recently came out with a book about the New York Islanders, right?
Yes. Besides rock music, I also do some sports books, and I just put out a book about the 1980s New York Islanders that won 4 Stanley Cups in a row. The album is called Dynasty, The Oral History of the New York Islanders, 1972 through 1984. And similar to, like I was saying before, I always do the oral history format, so this is no different. I did the same thing where I interviewed a lot of the players and coaches during that era, and I was able to get the story on that team that won 4 Stanley Cups and won 19 straight playoff series, which no other professional sports team has ever done, and I predict will never do again.
Yeah. And judging by your prolific nature, I'm assuming you're probably working on something else right now, are you?
I can say that I'm working on 2 projects currently, but I cannot go public with what they are, unfortunately. But when I can, I will let you know.
Oh, perfect.
Well, I mean, just for people that want to see what I'm up to, you could always go to my Twitter page. That, like, I always give, like, little things as to, like, what I'm doing. And I also post if I have a new book out or if I have a new article with Rolling Stone. And that people can go to is twitter.com/Greg Prado Writer.
Perfect. Well, I want to thank you, Greg. It's a great book, and you're right. I mean, it's the first book about Meat Puppets ever out, and it's important that it's out there. Thank you for being on my show.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the kind words. And I hope everyone checks out the book and also enjoys it.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Matt.
You've been listening to a conversation with Greg Prato about his book, Too High to Die, Meet the Meat Puppets, self-published at lulu.com in 2012. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for more interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.